Good day, everyone. This is March Twisdale, producer and host of Prose, Poetry, and Purpose. You're listening today to my interview with Patricia Ballantyne, recorded in the studio of Voice of Vashon on Vashon, Washington. So, Patricia, thank you for calling in today.
Thank you for the invitation.
Yay!
Looking forward to it.
I'm going to go ahead and ask you for a moment to ground our listeners a little bit in sort of who you are. Just basically set the stage.
A little bit about me.
Yeah.
Well, in this moment, I am in the Phoenix, Arizona area.
Mm-hmm.
It's where I have a primary residence. You and I, as I say, met up in Hood Sport, Washington. My husband and I have some property that we've just purchased up there that we plan to spend more time on as we move into retirement.
Mm-hmm.
But life here in Arizona is very busy for me, and I've spent about 40 years working in the engineering field.
Mm-hmm.
And over about the last 20 or 25 years, spent much more time exploring my own spirituality, things that I believe, and looking back over my life and putting a different look on it that mm-hmm. helps me understand how some really beautiful things can come out of what can be perceived as tragedy.
Right. So, yeah, you definitely have some personal experiences that you have in a way been able to move through, and you're gifting back to other people sort of the insights that you've gained and what's worked for you. We will get to that. But what I thought would be really fun would be to actually start off with the children's book first. So the title is My Grandma is a Witch, and the subtitle is A Tale of Religious Acceptance.
The witches in my storybooks are wicked, and they're mean. They cackle while they stir their pots. They're wrinkled, and they're green. They gobble little children up. They ride a magic broom. They cast a spell to get their wish. Cross stormy skies, they zoom. My head was really spinning with all these scary thoughts. I searched my brain to try and think what she cooks in her pot.
And that is your grandson thinking about you, correct?
Yes, it is.
Right.
This book was inspired by a conversation that I had with my grandson. He, at the time, was telling me he'd come spend the night, and we were talking about getting a movie to watch. And he was explaining to me that he didn't want to watch any movies about witches because they were really mean and they ate children and they were really scary.
And you must have been like, whoa.
I was thinking, well, and this is my son's little boy.
Right.
And before I left traditional religion, I was a very good Catholic, and I raised my son to be Catholic. And so mm-hmm. thus my grandson is Catholic as well.
Mm-hmm.
And so we really never talked about grandma being a witch before.
Mm-hmm.
And I knew that he was very young, but the time would come when we would need to have a conversation about what was true and what was not.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's why even in the illustrations of the book, for the most part, they're photographs.
Yeah, I'm looking at them.
Because witches are real.
Mm-hmm.
And yet there's this fairy tale image that's been created, and not to say that there are things in the fairy tales that are not true as well.
Mm-hmm.
However, that's not an authentic representation of what a witch truly is.
I would imagine the flying around on a broomstick is part of the inauthenticity.
I want to preface by saying that what I share here in this conversation, I always try to get these words in when I mm-hmm. have the opportunity to speak, is, you know, this is what's true for me,
mm-hmm.
and there are many, many interpretations as far as what's true about being a witch or witchcraft or Wicca, but no, I don't have a broom that I fly around in.
Mm-hmm.
However, I do cook special things in my pots. I stir love and magical intentions into
mm-hmm.
them.
What I love about the front cover here is I believe you have a Star of David, the moon and the star at the bottom left, that would be Islamic. Mm-hmm. symbolism. Then there's the yin yang, the Christian cross. What is this? The star in the middle with the rainbow colors.
It's a pentagram.
One of the points that you had made earlier when we were chatting was that this isn't designed just around your belief. It's really an idea of you could put anything in that spot. My grandma is a Jew. My grandma is a Buddhist. My grandma is an atheist. My grandma is a blank.
Exactly. And that's why in the book in the back, there are a number of other religious mm-hmm. symbols. that are all identified. And my point,
oh, right,
really, even to put it very succinctly, is that there's much separation and confusion that is created by assumptions
mm-hmm.
around what a person or a religious expression or religious group believes.
Mm-hmm.
And we really can benefit by coming to the place that we're sitting and having a conversation face-to-face
mm-hmm.
about really what is true and what is not. What do I believe? So that I have the opportunity to explain, this is what being a witch is to me.
Mm-hmm.
But and even in that word, when I was creating the book, I specifically used that word, witch,
mm-hmm.
Not so much as a trigger, but as an identifier.
Right.
It was interesting as I was creating it, and it was about a 2-year creative process, when I would put inquiries out to different groups, say, this is what I'm writing, I'd like your feedback, your mm-hmm. input on it. Many times people would come back and they'd say, well, a witch, knowing me, they would say, well, why wouldn't you say, I don't think you should use that word, I think you should say a light worker, or witch is a negative connotation. And
mm-hmm.
even people would say, well, I don't know any witches. I don't do anything that's black or dark magic.
Mm-hmm.
And therein is the example of why it was important
mm-hmm.
to use that word, because that created the opportunity for the dialogue.
Exactly.
Which was so important.
Right. You identified the white elephant rather than dodging it.
Right.
And this is a children's book. So, I mean, yeah. My grandma's a light worker. I mean, that's not going to help children who are being inundated by a mainstream society's viewpoint of what a witch is. So you
exactly.
allow them to,
yeah.
as you say, settle in on, oh, I know what I think a witch is. And then they go,
mm-hmm.
oh, well, wait a minute, it can be something different.
Yes, indeed.
Yeah. And on the back, there's a brilliant section. Let me see. Is it only 2 pages long? Yes, 2 pages in the back. Sufi, Confucian, Native people, Hindu, all these other ones that didn't show up in the front cover.
Uh-huh.
And on the back, there's 5 circles. It says, are there more signs that you would like to draw? Well, my son actually filled one of them in, and he filled it in as a peace sign.
Uh-huh. Absolutely.
I'd like to remind our audience that you're listening to Prose, Poetry, and Purpose on Voice of Vashon, the show where authors share how they hope to inspire positive change in the world, one reader and one listener at a time. My name is March Twisdale. I'm speaking today with Patricia Ballantyne, and we're discussing one of her 2 books here, My Grandma is a Witch, A Tale of Religious Acceptance. So if we dive in here a little bit, and you're right, there are all these photos, and that is your actual grandson, yes?
Yes, it is.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Awesome.
And my son is pictured in there as
okay.
well.
Okay. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Excellent. All right, good. So so let's see here. This is a great book, I think, for anyone who wants to have a conversation with a child. You live in a culture that has a mainstream viewpoint, and then if you're part of a minority group, if you're part of other, doesn't really matter what it is, this book actually could help that conversation. I really like how gently it's laid out, and there's nothing aggressive or defensive. It's just beautiful. The conversation is great. And near the back, though, you do start getting into a little bit more of some of the details around, for example, the pentagram, which in Hollywood, it's something you draw on the ground and you pull demons up and do horrible things with or something
uh-huh.
crazy. Why don't you explain the true symbolism for you around the pentagram and give us another viewpoint?
Okay. Well, for me, it's the 5-pointed star inside a circle.
Mm-hmm.
And the 5 points on the star represent air, fire, water, earth, and spirit.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a visual of how the elements that we experience out around us are within us. Have you ever seen Leonardo da Vinci's Vitruvian Man? He's standing there in a circle, and he has
yeah.
his arms extended, and his legs are slightly spread.
Yeah.
Within that image is exactly the same thing as the 5-pointed star.
Mm-hmm.
I am the human expression of those elements and spirit embodied.
Oh,
and so
right.
that's what that represents. This is a way of saying these elements make up who I am, and that's those are my tools to work with. That's mm-hmm. my relationship with nature.
And so let's see. What I find interesting here is you did a drawing project. So for people who are dealing with conversations of this sort with particularly young children, and your son, who's still a practicing Catholic, participated in this?
He did. As we were going through the book, he did. So there's an image there that has the five-pointed star, mm-hmm. and then there's an overlay of the Christian symbol of the cross.
That's pretty.
So within the same space, and what we're really talking about in this book is the place where our hearts connect.
Right.
And that inside each one of our hearts, there may be a special symbol or a sign.
Right. Wow, this is just brilliant. I mean, I liked reading it, but I'm really enjoying hearing you talk about it. And so, yeah, I see the page where it says, then Grandma drew more hearts and circles on the paper on the floor, and she began to draw all kinds of signs that I have seen before. And they're all inside of the hearts. Yay! Uh-huh.
Because
so
it's
pretty.
Really about what is inside of us.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I'm not going to give a spoiler alert. I'm just going to not spoil. I love the little cute thing at the end. and I'll just let everyone figure that out when they get the book. Yeah.
For many of us, there's a read or a guideline. There are also different interpretations. But mm-hmm. essentially, these are the words. Bide the Wiccan reed, ye must. In perfect love and perfect trust. 8 words of the Wiccan Reed fulfill, and harm ye none, do as ye will. Ever mind the rule of 3, what ye send out comes back to thee. Follow this with mind and heart, and merry you'll meet and merry part.
That's beautiful.
It is, and it really also aligns with what we see through the Golden Rule.
Mm-hmm.
And harm ye none, do as you will, is the Wiccan language that corresponds, I believe, with the other faith expressions that have something that relates to that Golden Rule. Mm-hmm. Do unto others as you would have them do unto you.
Mm-hmm. You know, it's fascinating growing older, and you don't realize when you're in your teen years especially, but even when you're in your 20s, you don't quite have, I mean, think about it, right? You know, you really sort of become an adult roughly around 18. I always talk about people being baby adults. I'm like, great, you're 18. You have accomplished childhood. You got it. You know how to be a child. You know how to be a teenager. You're brilliant at it. And now you're a baby adult.
Mm-hmm.
And this is the beginning. You know, it's not like you have achieved adulthood. No way, right? You know?
Right.
But you don't know that when you're 20. So as I've gotten older, and I'm enjoying the rolling insights and whatnot, and one of those things that often I just have nailed to the wall repetitively, like it just is endlessly confirmed by what I see in the world around me, is that the vast majority of people hold so much in common, and that there are, whenever you feel like you are absolutely in opposition to another viewpoint or another religion or another political party or whatever it is, those people out there that are trying to divide and conquer us by making us think that we are enemies amongst ourselves, it's always someone with a bias who's playing the game, who's trying to get something out of making us unable to sit down, like you say, and talk to each other. Because mm-hmm. when we do, it's so beautiful to recognize the 95% of that which we pretty much agree on.
Yeah, we don't know what we don't know.
Right.
We move through life and we're having experiences and we're living and we're learning. But there's always, for me, something that I didn't realize I didn't know in communication,
mm-hmm.
you know, in the way that I was thinking. Before I developed what are my beliefs today, there are tremendous things that are really important to me now that they were not even a concept in my mind.
Mm-hmm.
And the only way to, I guess maybe the first step is just to be able to say in any step or in any situation, I don't know what I don't know. I'm doing the best that I can with the information that I have right now.
Right.
But I am going to be willing to say that there could be something that I can learn.
Yeah.
There can be something different out there. So one of the things that I appreciate about, and I'll say Wicca as I practice it or as it was taught to me, is that there must always be an element of change. So I can go through a year and I can follow my practice, but I get to, you know, the time of the year where I'm thinking about a new dream, and it can't be exactly the same as last year. There's something new to be learned. Life, nature, the universe, everything has changed in a sense. Nothing stays exactly the same.
Ever.
And the willingness to, you know, to be open to that is part of the magical formula.
Yes. Oh, so let's use this to launch into the second book a little bit. Reduced to Abundance, Releasing Tragedy, Choosing Beauty. So we have here sort of like a top three things that we definitely want to touch upon with regard to this book. Why don't you first ground us a little bit, just give us a little bit of the backstory, because this book does come from a personal experience in your life. Do you want to ground us a little bit in that first? Okay,
absolutely. Reduced to Abundance, Releasing Tragedy, Choosing Beauty. Really is a recap of about almost 60 years of life for me. As a young child, when I was about 5 years old, I experienced incest. And so the first 30 years of my life were spent and lived as a result of that experience, but also as the result of my family of origin's actions and reactions as I was growing up. And so this book was actually written in 2005, after my mother had passed away. And one of the things that I realized through the process was that in my development of a completely different way of looking at an experience of incest as a child, I really had to get to the point for myself where I had the courage to say, it is a plague. It is something where the victim is often made responsible for keeping secrets. But for me, I look back at my life, and it was a purposeful piece of my own development and evolution. So I can't look at that today through the lens of a victim. I look at that experience as a life experience that led me to the point that I'm living the life that I am today.
You know, that is such a non-victim way of looking at it.
Well, we have victim consciousness is a very powerful thing, and it's very prevalent in lots of different layers.
Right.
But even being able to identify what that term really means, I've studied a few things over the years that relate to what's languished as the drama triangle and victim consciousness that really helped me understand how I even could look at very tragic life experiences and get to a place where I no longer had an energetic charge when I thought about them or when I revisited in some way those experiences. And I think that's really part of what, you know, the magical piece that I live as well. That's how it all goes together. Because for me, nature happens in cycles. And I've developed a process over the years where I can look back at my life and I can see very distinctive cycles where even from the time that I was 3 years old up until current date, just about every 3 years, there's a major transition. And so I could observe that. And then I could also get to the point where I realized that, you know, we have these things that come up for us all the time that are a bump for us. We don't really know what the trigger is. But again, for myself, I kind of developed a process where I can say, okay, well, now here's the trigger. What's this about? And I can go back, whether it's through my journaling that I've done previous and over previous years, and I can see where there are patterns, whether it's a seasonal pattern, it's a pattern of, you know, when I'm in conversation with particular people. But I can develop my own awareness of what is behind the trigger and what the patterns are, and that will help support me in being able to move through to a place where even something as inappropriate as incest is at a place in my life where I can speak about it, I can think about the people that were involved, and I truly have no energetic charge from it any longer. And that's the place where I know for myself that healing has happened.
It feels like acceptance, and not acceptance like this is okay acceptance, but you know, we have a charge because we still have something to work out.
I think that's a good way of looking at it. Yeah.
Okay.
I think that's a good way of looking at it. And I think that you know, there is I'll call it a philosophy out there today that also is less inclined than what I am to, when those things come up, those unresolved issues, to actually go into them, face them, deal with them.
Mm-hmm.
Life is not all good. In my world, I can't look at life and say, well, you know, everything's good, everything happens for a reason. My world isn't like that. There are things that come around that are coming around so that we can address them and then release them so that we don't continue on in future lifetimes, because I do believe in reincarnation, dealing with these same sorts of issues. It's not to say that if I experienced incest as a child and I never addressed it, that I would experience incest as a child in the next lifetime. That's not what it is.
Right.
But it's more about the energy of it, actually.
So, yeah, that's what it is. So, I happen to know, I've been in situations where people have said things like, you know, everything happens for a reason, and, you know, and the sense I have a lot of times is that that's actually a coping mechanism for a person who doesn't want to face the pain of perhaps either the reality around them or their own unresolved issues. And so to avoid that, they come up with sort of this mantra, belief, veneer of, you know, this stock phrase that very much is a way of stepping back and separating yourself. It's a way of removing yourself from it. And it's not so much being objective, but I think you know the word I'm looking for. There's a distance that you're creating. And
separation from it.
Yeah, and whether you put a Band-Aid on a wound and you know, are covering up something you haven't dealt with, or whether you distance yourself from it, it's still really, you know, it's a coping mechanism. And that's fine. I have zero judgment on any person for how they deal with their life on this complicated, messy planet. But I do believe we were talking a little bit earlier, and we wanted to make sure to, because you say at the very beginning here, it says, Reduced to Abundance is my personal story of transformation from victim of incest to incest survivor. There's nothing in this book that at all is trying to avoid or ignore sort of the incredibly impactful, inappropriate, negative aspect of what you experienced. At the same time, there's not a desire to dwell permanently in this role as a victim. And there's also, you were very clear earlier in saying that you are concerned that when people step into that that separated, distanced place of, oh, everything, da-da-da-da-da-da-da, and they say that to someone else who's currently in the middle of a really horrific, emotionally painful and traumatic situation, what were you saying, that it dismisses their pain?
I don't know. It can do harm.
Right.
So let me go back.
Yeah.
What you were just saying about from victim of incest to incest survivor.
Right.
And let me continue on, because there's another piece to that. And that's really where I feel I stand.
Mm-hmm.
So it's from victim to survivor to the responsible creator of a life filled with opportunities to love more deeply, live more responsibly, and soar more freely.
Mm-hmm.
So that's what my path has been. I wrote the book. There are a couple of things in here that really relate to these different ways of looking at things.
Mm-hmm.
I use the analogy of the type of lenses that we wear, the glasses that we wear.
Mm-hmm.
I have an older sister and a younger sister. And my older sister is one who always would want to look at life through the rose-colored lenses.
Mm-hmm.
Not one who was comfortable with challenging experiences, really just wanted to be able to see the good. So her coping mechanisms were not, she didn't come in with the tools to be able to handle challenges real
mm-hmm.
well. My younger sister, her lenses are very dark, like dark sunglasses. And she, my analogy for her was that she wears those glasses so that people can't see when she's crying. And so that would be her defense mechanism. My glasses were the magnifiers. I'm the one in the family who wanted to dig in, find out what the stories behind the stories were, and come to some point of resolution on certain things so that I could move forward.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I can't say that people who look through the rose-colored lenses will say, as I use my older sister as an example, there are people who absolutely believe in it, completely works for them, to say that everything happens for a reason. They live that, they believe that, and that's the way their life unfolds.
Mm-hmm.
My concern is that oftentimes when that's shared with another person as if it is the only truth.
Right.
That's where the pain or the judgment comes in.
Right.
I can say that this is true for me, but I have a challenge when it comes to generalizations that say, well, this is the reality. It is mm-hmm. a reality. It is a way to live my life, and it may work absolutely well, magically, for people. That's
mm-hmm.
not my particular path.
Well, it certainly doesn't seem, when we look at human history, current and in the past, it does not seem to ever function very well for a Homo sapiens sapien to walk up to another Homo sapiens sapien and say, what I think is what everyone on this huge globe should think, and if they disagree with me, they're wrong.
And those things happen, don't they?
Yeah. People keep trying to pull that one off. It hasn't worked yet.
No, really? It hasn't worked yet. It hasn't worked
yet. I mean,
yet.
It can look like it's working if you've got, you know, a bunch of weapons and you're going to kill the person if they don't pretend they agree with you. But, I mean, seriously, the lack of humility in the person who believes they have the answer for every other 7 billion people on the planet is quite interesting.
Yeah, well, and I think that there's something about that, you know, in some of the philosophies that I've studied, there's, you know, when we talk about the evolution of humanity or the evolution of man, we can talk about mass consciousness, individuation, and group consciousness.
Hmm.
And there are a lot of people who really talk about the awakening these days. And,
right.
and what they're really holding in their mind and heart is the group consciousness. However, mm-hmm. my belief is that unless I have as an individual
mm-hmm.
have come to the place where I can stand and be very aligned and sovereign and clear
mm-hmm.
about what is true for me and bring that into a group environment,
mm-hmm.
that's the work of our generations right now.
Mm-hmm.
That mass consciousness is where people are following and they don't even know what or why.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
They don't know the details.
Right.
They don't get the information. They're not really making informed decisions.
Right.
And that can be true of people who are following New Thought and New Age things as well.
Sure.
It's comfortable in the moment or whatever the draw is. But unless they've kind of gone through that place where they're saying, okay, I've worked through enough pieces in my life where I can clearly say, this is in the moment, because it's always changing,
mm-hmm.
this is what I believe, this is where I am, this is what is true for me, and then this is what I bring into the group. And I want to be involved in group with people who are also clear in and of themselves. It's, you know, that's what sovereignty is. Well, and there's a real power there.
Right. And, you know, and it's the yin and yang, the push and pull of, you know, the group and the individual. Mm-hmm. You know, I don't even like the word versus because of all it implies. You know, I mean, it's more like it's and, you know, we need community and we need individual, because if you have a bunch of individuals that are really messed up, then your community is going to suck, you know.
That's where getting aligned with yourself is important.
Right.
You know, we've got a phrase that we talk about, we often hear about being in groups of like-minded people.
Right.
And
birds of a feather.
Arizona, yeah. Here in Arizona, my husband and I host gatherings here in our home on a regular basis. And we've come over the last year to realize that what we're about really is not like-minded people,
mm-hmm.
but it really goes back to the children's book. We're looking for people with open minds
mm-hmm.
and open hearts
mm-hmm.
who want to continue to learn and grow and understand.
Right.
So, you know, it's not so much that like-minded thing as it is being open-minded.
Well, and honestly, like-minded people can sometimes be really boring to hang out with. I mean, they're just saying the same thing you already think. I mean, where's the adventure and the exploration and the discovery and the conversation? Honestly, I don't do the, oh, I know, yeah, right. I don't do those conversations, you know, where you're just sitting there patting each other on the back, you know. I want people to challenge me in a non-aggressive way, more like an exciting, did you know this way? That's
mm-hmm.
that's the chewiness of life, I think.
Yeah, I would agree with that. You know, one of the things is I'm sitting here looking at my computer here in my office is I've got that little post-it note, and it says, and I love debate.
Mm-hmm.
Debate is fueled by passion.
Mm-hmm.
Argument is heated by anger or fear.
Oh, my gosh.
And
oh, my gosh.
Times,
that's great.
A lot of times people are really resistant to debate because, you know, our energy shifts and we get maybe a little bit more animated. And it's really passion. It's not anger. It's not fear. We're not really arguing.
Mm-hmm.
But that energy shift is something that can be challenging. And I think debate is important when we're talking about some of these really profound and different ways of looking at life.
Okay, so debate is fueled by passion, argument
yes.
is fueled by anger?
Argument is heated by anger or fear. So debate is fueled by passion. Argument is heated by anger or fear.
And that is why Martin Luther King was so amazing, because he was passionate and he got up and he spoke about that which he was passionate about, rather than, you know, the people who you don't really feel good after you listen to them because they're just ranting with anger and fear.
Right. And so that was where in my role as the daughter with the magnifying lens,
mm-hmm.
you know, that I had a passion for exploration
mm-hmm.
of what my own story was. And what had happened within my family.
Well, and you,
it wasn't to be argumentative. It
right.
was a different thing.
Well, and you speak to the role of secrets. And so, you know, I mean, some of what many of us understand to be the sister-sibling problems when it comes to child abuse, whatever form it is, you know, but especially incest is when, you know, the family pride is on the line. And so, you know, there's the hushed whisperings or the, you know, the looks and the white elephants just start to, like, you know, have babies as, like, you know, they breed like rabbits, you know, you got white elephants mm-hmm. all over the place. So much of that is covered in here. But what I think is really unique about your book, since there are other books that deal with this topic, your book is not huge. It is not a lengthy dissertation. It is not a textbook. It's 84 pages of very, very focused, rich communication. One thing I want to mention for my listeners is, so first of all, there's an aspect of description of some of the home life environments, like your grandmother's kitchen, that really do paint a very, very visual and powerful image. So for people who don't want a dry nonfiction, you know, text, this book is going to work for you. There's poetry mixed in quite a bit. But I love you have the first section is the crown chakra, perception of oneness. And then let's see. And there's a really pretty picture. So they're even easy to find. And then we get to the next pretty picture, which is the brow chakra. No, wait. Chakra? Oh, you know you got a typo there.
Where?
I'm sorry. It says Sharka.
Where at? Which?
It's brow, the third eye.
Yes. Thank you.
I'm sorry. Okay.
I love finding that.
So then we have the brow chakra. Okay. And
right,
it goes on through all of these. So I know a lot of people on the island who are fascinated with the realm of thought, belief, medicine that deals with chakras. And I thought it was really beautiful that this book pulls that together with this very important subject of incest.
And that was something that kind of unfolded on its own. It's not that I had intended really to address the chakra system, because I'm not really very knowledgeable about it. But what I realized as I was putting the pieces together is that in order to, in my experience again, in order to really deal with the a sexual violation, that it took a holistic approach. And I realized as I was going back over the many years and exploring my own journaling and different things, I realized that something happened that I could correlate to each one of the chakras.
And that
it identified, at least in my experience, where all of those pieces needed to come together. And so that chakra reference actually came after I wrote the piece of poetry that then prefaces each one of the chapters. And so I write all of this, and I look at it and going, wow, we're talking about the our relationship with God, our relationship with self. Our heart center, and it flowed that there was really a chapter that came out of each one of those verses that revealed to me that it aligned with the chakra systems.
Right. And I love, it's like, you know, heart chakra, love and trust. So in a way, it's like the idea of I'm going to transition from victim to survivor to transformative self, you know, self-transformative chooser of my life, you know, like really this is about finding empowerment when really I would say incest is of any sort, but especially when you're super young, is the absolute definition maybe of powerlessness.
It seems so at the time, yes.
Yeah, and so it's like you're, by going through the chakras, it's just a reminder that every layer of us is a piece of us authentically. And if we're going to grow and trans, you know, you can't grow up if your feet don't grow and the rest of you does and you're walking around on baby feet, you know? I mean,
that's
it's like
a really good way of putting it.
The whole thing has to grow.
Absolutely.
Yeah. And in a way, it's important to keep looking around and keep searching to find the pieces that maybe need a little bit more growth, love, and support, and get ourselves to not an end point, but to what would you call it? What would be the goal for a person who's listening right now who maybe is feeling extremely uncomfortable?
It's a spiral. And so, you know, you're really, and I guess in my last chapter of the book, I really address that. It's not like everything is done. I've accomplished all of this healing, and now what's left is, I guess, on the last page here. I said, "And in what is true for me, it is the soulful work that prepares the way for the ongoing adventure when the carousel ride of this lifetime pauses." And the next begins. So it's an ongoing journey. This was an experience that I had in this lifetime that's been profound, and I think that there were very significant lessons that were mine to learn.
Right.
During this lifetime, that the stage was set when I came in, based on the parents and the family that I was born into, to have this experience. And I think that was probably the hardest thing for me to wrap myself around, being able to say, being able to say that even something as I say, something as horrific as incest can be very, very purposeful in the unfolding of a life.
It can be, but it's ultimately your choice whether to make it that or not.
Well, and I came in with the tools to be able to unravel it in a different way.
And I'm assuming so, there were...
Not just about choice. I don't think it's just about choice. I think that we come in with certain tools from past lives and enable us to handle experiences particular ways. Now, it could be a matter of choice when we get to the point that we're adults and we've had opportunities to learn things. If we turn our back on that, then we'll probably come around and have similar experience again.
And you were saying...
Therein is choice.
When you mentioned reincarnation earlier, I immediately jumped to the, I believe it's the Hindu belief of reincarnation, that it's really quite... prevalent in India and places in the surrounding area. And then you mentioned that early Christianity included a belief in reincarnation. Until when was it that that changed?
It was around the, I think it was 454. So the early church, and keeping in mind that Christianity wasn't Christianity.
Right. It was forming.
So I'm looking at my thing here. For the first 400 years, reincarnation was part of the Christian doctrine. And there was a point in time when the powers that be in Rome inflicted or imposed, I guess, a desire to change what was considered the doctrine of the church. Not uncommon. It happens, you know, many times along the line.
Yeah, exactly.
So, but it was written out of the original doctrine. So,
oh, yeah, it was. It's in my notes here. It's Emperor Justinian in 545 AD.
545, yes.
Right.
So it was 500 years after the death of Christ.
Right.
That it was decided that, that Christianity would no longer embrace the fabulous pre-existence of souls and the assertion of the monstrous restoration which follows from it.
Interesting. Yeah. There's just, you know, so many. It's, isn't that fascinating, right? You know, the person who wants to control the thoughts of others versus, you know, the people who maybe want to be able to choose for themselves what to believe.
Yes.
And let's see. So we are unfortunately running out of time. And I want to get a couple more of these specific things. And you have a reading you're going to do on page 18. We'll finish with that. And you mentioned that, in particular, how we identify core wounds is very important. Do you want to speak to that for a moment?
Yeah, I'll just briefly say that in my experience, and much of what I've shared in the book, is that I went through 20 years of therapy before I had some really mystical experiences that led me to looking at life a bit differently.
And hold on, so you were raised Catholic?
I was raised Protestant. I married into the Catholic tradition with my my son's father. He was Catholic. But oftentimes, and I hear this from others who have been who have experienced things such as incest. That is that sexual experience or sexual assault or attack is considered the core wound. In my case, the core wound was not the the violation. It was my family of origin's reaction to the experience. So that really was the core wound that it took me many, many years to move through and heal.
Right, you speak to that in the book I'm imagining people who have perhaps experience with various forms of abuse will be able to relate very much with, you know, the fear as a young child of answering a question too honestly, you know, when posed by another child, and having your mother basically get mad at you, not because she was trying to protect you, but because she was trying to actually protect, you know, the family. What would that be, the family image or the family reputation or something?
Well, it wasn't so much as that. It really is, she had a story behind the story.
Right.
And so I, very late in her life, realized that she had also experienced something similar that I had within the family. She mm-hmm. had experienced a sexual assault as a child.
Mm-hmm.
And so she, because she was never able to move through or heal that, she didn't know what she didn't know.
Mm-hmm.
She didn't know that she had the power to live her life differently.
Mm-hmm.
And therefore, raise her children differently.
And even though obviously Christianity, whether it's Protestant or Catholicism or whatever, clearly would, would speak very much against, incest and such actions of sexual violation. At the same time, I think you were mentioning that it was important for people to consider that there could be value for them to look outside of the faith that they were raised in, or how did you word it? Look for non-traditional ways of moving forward. I mean, my perspective oftentimes is that there's a great deal of sort of judgment and blame and right and wrong focusing in the more traditional forms of Catholicism and Christianity. I could see how that, and if you look at all the secrecy that's happened around, you know, the priests and stuff in the Catholic Church over the last 50, whatever, you know, forever,
mm-hmm.
Clearly secrets get kept in that faith a little bit more often than maybe we would want. So I think you wanted to make the point that it can be very useful for people to explore alternative modalities.
Yes, absolutely. That's what my experience was. I went through traditional therapy for 20 years, and it never really identified what the core wound was for me.
Mm.
And so it wasn't until I had a mystical experience, I decided that I was going to spend more time in nature. I was touched by the goddess. I was opened up to completely different ways of looking at life, the
mm-hmm.
purpose of life. And those things enabled me to have a completely different set of tools to handle and process through this life experience.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, that set of tools, I put my own tool bag together.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what I felt was really important. It's not that even my way is the way anybody else who's had this experience should attempt.
Mm-hmm.
But the willingness to say, okay, you know, that way of looking at it, that particular therapy process isn't getting me to a place where I'm not having that energetic charge.
Right. So we don't necessarily want a person to say to themselves, this is such a horrific experience that the current modality I'm using is absolutely perfect. I'm just going to have to be here for 35 more years. We want them to maybe be a little bit more vigorous in a way and saying, well, okay, I'm going to try this and I'm going to feel my way through it for the first year or two or 6 months or whatever. And if I'm feeling like it's helping, great. If I get to a point where I feel like it's stagnating, where I feel like I'm not moving forward, I give myself permission to step sideways and explore another alternative, you know, another option, because this is a incredibly diverse planet and there's all these options out there. It maybe doesn't make sense to stick with just one method.
That's a good way of putting it. Yes,
okay.
Being, you know, getting to that point where you're willing to take that sidestep.
Yeah.
And
you'll
that's
be
that
the one. That's
that part of individuation, you know, being able to
right.
say, this doesn't feel right and true for me.
And you'll be the one to know, because oftentimes Oh, across the board, whether it's the education of our children, does my child have ADHD or not? You know, what type of medical decisions should I make? You know, across the board, we oftentimes give up our autonomy to experts out there and just assume they know more than us, even when our gut is screaming at us maybe to go another direction. So in a way, stepping into adulthood more fully is also having more honor for your instincts and more trust in yourself. And you're not always going to be right, and you don't have to just blow off the experts because they can have a lot to offer, but
Right.
definitely start to grow in your own belief in your own self.
Well, and I think that's trying to come to the point where I know we need to wrap this up.
Yeah.
This poem really speaks to that, I think, for me, because really what we're talking about is how we are within our skins. Do we feel like we're authentically living, authentically alive, or not? I wrote this poem right after my mother passed away. And as I say, this book really is much to do with my family of origin and my journey being much different. It's unique compared to my sisters and my mom and my stepdad and my dad. And what I realized in the moments of her death is that I had the opportunity to experience whether or not I was really authentically being myself. So this is the poem. One of the things I experienced in the end is the awareness that in that moment, when you are waiting for someone you love to stay in the pause between the in-breath and the out-breath, when you are waiting for their last heartbeat, quite often your own breath stops rather than theirs. And you feel like your heart will never beat again. That is the moment, or even the split second, when you get a flash of knowing if you are authentically alive or not. And that's what it's all about.
We may or may not get more than one life, but the life we're in right now, let's fully embrace it.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Patricia, thank you so much for spending some time with me.
Thank you for the invitation. Magic happens in coffee shops when we take the time to speak with a stranger.
I know. Don't, absolutely. Absolutely. It was, and you and I were both working, remember? Like I was
Yeah,
going to
we
do,
were.
we were
Like,
both
would you
like,
like to share my little table here? I'm plugged in with my computer.
I know. I was like, okay, we're going to cram in some work time and then blink, blink. Next thing you know, we start chatting. It was brilliant. The universe brought us together for a reason.
Absolutely, I believe in that.
Okay, so that's our show, folks. My name is March Twisdale, and you've been listening to my interview with Patricia Ballantyne. You can learn more about her at her website, thecreativeflame.com. We were talking about reduced to abundance, releasing tragedy, choosing beauty, and also a children's book called My Grandma is a Witch, A Tale of Religious Acceptance. And I'm just going to throw out there, it could be this book does more than just focus on that one concept. It really could be my grandma is a blank, a blank, a blank, a blank. So this is a brilliant book, no matter what way in which you may or may not feel that you are other than the mainstream. This is a great tool for talking with a great tool for talking with children. In particular, it's brilliant. Okie doke.
Thank
So,
you.
yeah. Oh, yeah. No, yay. So, thank you for tuning in, everybody, to Prose, Poetry, and Purpose, where my guest authors share how they hope to inspire positive change in the world, one reader and one listener at a time. And now I'll leave you with the inspirational and timely song, We Are the Many, created by musical activist Makana.
Hey, come here, gather round the stage. The time has come for us to voice our rage against the ones who've trapped us in a cage. to steal from us the value of our wage. From underneath the vestiture of law, the lobbyists at Washington do gnaw. At liberty, the bureaucrats guffaw. And until they are purged, we won't withdraw. We'll occupy the streets, we'll occupy the courts, we'll occupy the offices of you till you do the bidding of the many, not the few. Our nation was built upon the right of every person to improve their plight. But laws of this republic they rewrite, and now a few own everything in sight. They own it free of liability. They own, but they are not like you and me. Their influence dictates legality. And until they are stopped, we are not free. We'll occupy the streets, we'll occupy the courts, we'll occupy the offices of you till you do the bidding of the many, not the few. You enforce your monopolies with guns while sacrificing our daughters and sons. But certain things belong to everyone. Your thievery has left the people none. So take heed of our notice to redress. We have little to lose, we must confess. Your empty words do leave us unimpressed. A growing number join us in protest. We occupy the streets, we occupy the courts, we occupy the offices of you till you do the bidding of the many, not the few. You can't divide us into sides, and from our gaze you cannot hide. Denial serves to amplify, and our allegiance you can't buy. Our government is not for sale. The banks do not deserve a bail. We will not reward those who fail. We'll not move till we prevail. We'll occupy the streets, we'll occupy the courts, we'll occupy the offices of you till you do the bidding of the many, not the few. We'll occupy the streets, we'll occupy the courts, we'll occupy the offices of you till you do the bidding of the many, not the few. We are the many, you are the few.